Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
I sometimes think of the analogy of the kitchen, where the kitchen is this explosive area of things flying all over the place, some things working out, etc. And then finally, it's brought out on a very clean plate, presented by a waiter that's very smartly dressed.
Hi, everyone. I'm Amy Devers.
I'm Jamie Derringer, and this is Clever. And today we're talking to product designer Carl Gustav Magnusson. Carl has had a long and illustrious career spanning many facets of design, graphics, automotive, product, furniture, education. And he's also worked with many legendary designers and brands, such as the Eameses, Knoll, BMW, Ross Lovegrove, Maya Lin, Frank Gehry, Ettore Sottsass, the list goes on and on. Although he was born in Sweden, he spent much of his childhood in Canada on a farm tinkering with the machines.
He studied engineering and architecture and then went to work with Charles and Ray Eames straight out of school. He spent the better part of 30 years working with renowned furniture brand Knoll and now runs his own product design studio. Maybe you've heard this definition of design. Design is function with cultural context. That comes from the mind of Carl. Well-rounded? Absolutely. He's got stories and ideas for miles. Let's talk to Carl.
I'm Carl Magnusson. I live primarily in New York City, but also in Milan. I'm an industrial designer, and my vocation and method of hopefully contributing to society's needs in a thoughtful way.
Wonderful. Why do you do it?
The accumulation of experiences in childhood, guidance from my parents, and maybe innate interests in how things work naturally led me to that direction. And I think it really all began when I was working on the farm.
Yeah, let's talk about your youth. So you were born in Sweden and then you grew up in Canada. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your childhood and how it shaped you.
I was born in Malmö at the southern tip of Sweden. That's across from Copenhagen, and you can now take a, after I think 200 years of arguing, they finally built a bridge between each other. And Malmö was a historic port of the, one of the historic ports of the Hanseatic Empire. That was the time when everything happened on water, and it was really only with the invention of steam railways that things started happening inland. But during the Second World War, we were stationed in Piteå. It's a wooded Lapland town near the Arctic Circle between Finland and Norway. Upon war's end, we moved to the plains of Canada to take over our grandparents' farm near Calgary, Alberta. The only thing common was the temperature, clear skies, occasional aurora borealis, not many people, So it was indeed a horizon broadening experience. Hmm. No trees.
Wow. What age were you when you moved?
7.
So do you remember a lot about your time in Sweden?
I remember that there was this little metal boat in the refrigerator that if you put the proper chemicals in, it could drive across the bathtub or something like that. Going out with my parents to find mushrooms, this happens to be a typical pastime of people in the Lapland area. And then when it was told to me that we were moving to another country and they were going to buy a new car in Windsor, just north of Detroit, they showed me a bunch of brochures, and there was a fabulous Lincoln Continental, which was done in beautiful watercolor, showing quite happy people next to their yacht. And I suggested that we should, you know, maybe get that. And they said, explained to me, look, we're farmers. We got the default dark blue Mercury four-door sedan and drove across the United States and then up into Canada. So those were my memories of Sweden until we got to North America.
And so when you're in Canada, what was your home life like? You mentioned running around on the farm.
It was really quite interesting. It was a large farm. We had a fairly large machine shop. Keep in mind that in Canada, everybody is an immigrant. We had 2 to 3 Germans working in the machine shop. I gravitated there. Perhaps because it was warmer, but really because you could take things apart and hopefully put them together. And they were very patient with me. And my father approved of it because he was an engineer. I really got into it right away. My sisters and I, we went to the school in the town. It was probably a couple of miles we would either bike in or walk in. There was no such thing as paved roads, which was just fine. You learned really how to bike. I do recall that nearly all the teachers were from England because Canada paid probably 3 times more. My father, who was an engineer from Uppsala University, encouraged me to start drawing. And he lent me his drafting instruments at the age of 12. Mm. And I started drawing cars in ink. You draw, you make a mistake with a razor blade, you erase it and start over. My mother was very kind and subscribed to Fortune magazine and Architectural Forum magazine, which even by today's standard or any standard was an extraordinary architectural magazine. And I was able to add to that Popular Mechanics and Rod and Customs from California to the list. I mean, I think my fate was sealed, especially with Rod and Custom. this was an area that I didn't realize until later on that may have been the essence of design, in that Hot Rod and Custom car people, they don't want to make the same thing the other person did.
Right.
It would just be a production car. So they were, by definition, individualized. I obviously was infected by this view of things and would study very carefully what one person did to their 39 Mercury coupe. That would be in the customs area because they didn't go very fast. And then, of course, what people were doing with 32 Fords, etc., which were to go fast. But out of that, you realized this sort of, not naive exactly, but these people didn't go to art center that were doing this. They intuitively figured out what new forms could be in the hot rodding area, finishes and performance and the expression of that. It's actually a very disciplined aesthetic area of design and very easy to under or overstep where it should be. So I love that stuff. And in fact, when I was 15, I was allowed to buy a car. Insurance wasn't the problem because you just drove around the farm, and I was admonished not to hit cattle. That was about the extent of it.
Just don't run over the cows, Carl. Otherwise, have at it.
Yeah. I mean, there were no other cars around that you would likely to hit, but you just had to be careful with those things. So I learned how to chop and channel. Terrible work, but at least I was able to somehow, I think probably my mother kept a photograph of me and the car at 15. It was a heck of a lot of fun, but you know, eventually it was time to move on to higher education.
I love the picture you've just painted for us, because it started with a young boy moving to a new country and being totally transfixed by a Lincoln Continental, and then living on a farm with a machine shop and full license to tinker and hot rod, and a family with engineering background and Architectural Forum magazine. So it sounds like your interests were all being kind of supported and nourished. It doesn't sound like you had any trouble giving yourself license to tinker around and really express yourself.
It was very much encouraged, partly because it was a respected discipline. Mm-hmm. It kept me out of trouble. I mean, quite frankly, in the plains of Alberta, there's not much trouble to get into, but never mind. Being on the farm allowed me a chance to understand how things work. Just the whole notion of, yeah, that's right. You plant the seeds, and then with perseverance, you wait until it's time to harvest, etc. A slightly slow process for someone who eventually wanted to become an industrial designer. But I really wanted to become a car designer, even at the age of 12. My father explained to me that designing cars is about as deep as designing a tie. I wish he was still around so I could tell him, you're right, Ralph Lauren started as a tie designer and has the greatest car collection in the world. But I sort of thought engineering, not really knowing what it was, but respecting what my parents were doing, I felt that that might be my calling. My sister already had a math scholarship at the University of Idaho. She was the one that got the grades, you know. Mm. It seemed to be a good option because it was only a couple of days' drive straight south.
Oh.
My roommate, Gordon Walker, now really a great architect in Seattle, suggested that architecture might be more fun because you can get to work all night. So I switched.
Okay, so you went to University of Idaho first to study engineering, and then you had this roommate, Gordon Walker, who said, hey, what about architecture? And you were like, that seems hot. I'll do that.
Yeah.
That kind of a story? Okay.
I mean, quite frankly, engineering was sort of a 9-to-5 study job, whereas architecture was never ending, and it just seemed to be more interesting. That went actually very well, but then my parents suggested I consider transferring to the Chalmers Institute of Technology in Gothenburg to continue the architectural studies. So I did. And when I was there, I had no idea how much fun education could be. We would go on field trips to the Royal Academy of Art in Copenhagen, and I listened to this guy called Paul Kerholm give a lecture. Fairly soon later, I started realizing how brilliant he was, and I continue to feel that today, to this day. There's something about the environment of Danish design that creates amazing, especially early modernist talents. Besides Paul Kerholm, Borg Mogensen, Mogen Koch, and of course Arne Jacobsen, who mm-hmm. is probably the epitome of all, who could design anything from a salt shaker to a building. So that was all really very interesting. But architecture itself is site specific. And therefore, it doesn't lend itself to duplication much. And I was more interested in the social impact of well-designed and mass-produced objects. And so my passion, I think, moved at that time towards industrial design. which was not taught there. I mean, had I known it, I would have studied at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, where my one of my sons later on did. And I continue to think that it's the most extraordinary place for an industrial designer. So when I finished my studies, I wrote a letter to Charles and Ray Eames with a small sketch of a museum exhibit I had done. I had just been working on a Braun exhibit for their first store in Sweden and a sports car showroom for the agent of Alfa Romeo, Lotus, and Morgan. In a few weeks, I received a positive response.
First of all, that sounds like a gutsy move. Second of all, those projects you just mentioned, were you, you're just out of school. Are you an intern or how did you get gigs like that?
I didn't have a lot of money. I mean, I was a student. I started to supplement my income. I started making candles in beer cans and...
Here we go. Here's the hot rodder.
You're right. And clothesline pins holding the wicks up. And much to my surprise, I just wanted to make a little bit of money, but it turned out I made quite a bit of money and moved out of the student apartment to a very small villa on the ocean side. And it turned out my neighbor was the guy who was the head of Braun Electric for Sweden. And I told him about my passion for all of Dieter Rams's works, et cetera. And he says, "Well, why don't you design this exhibit then in our the new store we're putting together?"
Wow. So
I did that together with doing the sports car showroom. I think helped me move in the direction I wanted to go in. I mean, I got the showroom job because I'm so enthusiastic about design that I think I sort of exuded it when I was in looking at all the cars I couldn't afford.
Oh, I have no doubt. And passion is totally infectious. And I think that your passion preceded you and got you some good gigs.
Yeah. Well, perhaps it did. When I finished up the project, I asked them if I could. I said, I'm going to move to United States. And I said, could I buy a Morgan from you at a discount? And I did and picked it up in New York City. And with really, I mean, you know, this was back in the late 60s, with really only about $100 or so, headed off to Venice. Gas was 30 cents a gallon. And we camped to save money. No problem. Sometimes we arrived at the campsite so late we didn't quite know how close they were to the railway tracks, etc. But anyway, it was a great time, and my young kids loved it, and all well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Support for Clever comes from Wix Studio. Instead of reading you another, let's be honest, boring ad script, Wix Studio just sent me this wild-looking Alice in Wonderland-themed website to scroll through and tell you about. So, whoa. This is not the web I'm used to. There's something called mouse parallax, which makes it feel like you can go deeper into the screen. And as I scroll down, it's like I'm falling down the rabbit hole. And things are moving in depth and perspective.
Even my cursor has morphed into a glowing little orb. There are all these no-code animations that make this place feel organic and alive. And Alice is wearing some pretty cool shoes, by the way. Okay, I know I'm mixing up my narratives now, but we are definitely not in Kansas anymore. Your turn to go down the rabbit hole. Build your next web project on Wix Studio, the platform for agencies and enterprises.
I mean, you were mentioning that it was a bit of a bold move to move from Sweden to Venice, but California. But really, I was already used to the idea of traveling. Having moved from, you know, southern Sweden to northern Sweden is about the distance of the height of California. And then moving over to Canada was, you know, 5,000-6,000 miles. So none of that actually was a deterrent. And later on in life, it actually became beneficial that I didn't see distance as an inhibitor. So I ended up at the Eames office in Venice. It was in 901 Washington Boulevard. With all a completely anonymous building with an old faded sign that said Bay City's Garage. Mm. There were two black Cadillac convertibles outside with white tops. One was Ray's and one was Charles. And then I think it was there was a pink Thunderbird that was the accountant, and it was perfectly fitting.
I love that you're already identifying people and their personalities by their cars.
Well, first of all, I always did.
Yeah.
And you learn in, I mean, it is its own visual language.
Yes.
And in Los Angeles, as the cliches go, you are what you drive. and as they also say, look, you can sleep in a car, but you can't drive a house. I'm sure that's from some Latin proverb or something like that.
Right.
But really, my tenure with the Eames office was that was my real design education. I had no idea what design could do until I came there. I mean, ranging from city planning, architecture, exhibitions, graphics, photography, and of course, furniture design. When I arrived there, they were finishing up Powers of 10. A friend of mine, Paul Breweiler, was the guy who was graphic designer and photographer, who was laying down on the grass being photographed. I mean, it was just a wonderful factory of ideas. And I worked on exhibits for the proposed National Aquarium, never came about, designed by Kevin Roach and Dinklo. IBM was one of their main clients, and the project I worked on was the analytical machine exhibit by Charles Babbage. He was a polymath from Britain, and his paramour, Lady Lovelace, the first computer program in the mid-1800s.
Wow.
The Herman Miller History Wall was a lot of fun. I was actually working under Deborah Sussman, the wonderful graphic designer who on her own created some of the World's Fair exhibits. And then the first foray actually into furniture was with Ray Eames. They had designed the new Eames chaise, intended to be in offices, very narrow, about 18, 20 inches wide or so. And she was working on the finishes and colors, and I was asked to help her out getting things like finishes to match up, and she wanted the frame to be an eggplant finish. So I ran out trying to find, I'd never seen an eggplant before, and ran out and trying to find one. We found it. She was traveling. The thing had faded by the time she got back. Well, I had to go out and get a fresh one so that the color was correct. But to this day, I'm thinking, what a brilliant insight into a color to use on a product like that. Because usually people gravitate to black, silver, white, you know, beige or something like this. But here's this eggplant and still wonderful with a lot of interesting people come by. Alexander Girard would visit with cartons of his toy collection for the creation of films that he was doing together with primarily Charles. And Saul Bass would make an occasional appearance. I'm not sure they did any work together, but nevertheless, they were comrades. My colleagues were from all over the globe, Australia, Japan, and it was a big experimental factory. And the vestiges of all the prior projects would hang from the ceiling. It was really quite wonderful. I mean, you really never wanted to go home. And actually, you weren't encouraged to because there was so much work. the work was the decoration. It was just constantly changing. There was never a sense that anything was finished. It was a continuous laboratory of ideas that were being put together primarily for IBM's exhibitions. And it really instilled in me an endless inspiration and confidence of what design can do, and hopefully how I could perhaps contribute. I left Eames' office to open my own office in Rudolf Schindler's house. And I knew that I'd learned a lot about slideshows and photography, et cetera, at the Eames' office. And I quickly got a project with Warner Brothers to do a 600-image slideshow for their new record introductions, such as Roxy, et cetera. I mean, it was all terrific stuff. And they were wonderful to work with because they had the money, they wanted it done fast, and they paid fast. and I said, well, would you mind advancing me so I could buy some motor drive Nikon? Sure, no problem. They just hand you a check and we run away. So it was great. Great fun being in Rudolf Schindler's house was wonderful. It was on King's Road in West Hollywood. I got to know his widow, Pauline, who was writing books on the future of, I think, socialism or something like that. And she kept on trying to sell me her Corvair. it was before Ralph Nader actually had destroyed the car.
Right.
But I'd asked if I could rent the garage because I was expanding. She says, if you buy the Corvair. and it didn't happen. But then Noel knocked literally on the door.
It wasn't what? Okay, so I was going to ask you about that. Did you go after Noel? Yeah. Or it sounds like they came to you. We need to hear this story.
They came to me. My affinity with the furniture industry was naturally with Herman Miller. I didn't really know much about Noel other than the names of the classic contributors. And, of course, Herman Miller had a beautiful showroom on Melrose Boulevard designed by the Eames office. I had visited the Noel showroom, and they asked if I would take over the management of showrooms and graphics. I didn't quite let on to the fact that I'd never managed really anything. and that applies, I think, to this very day. But nevertheless, that all worked out very well. They said to me, but you know, you realize you're going to have to leave Southern California to New York. Well, not having been in New York and having been brought up primarily in Northern Canada and Northern Sweden, how bad could the weather be? So I said, yeah, it's fine. Let's do it. And so pretty soon we were in New York, and that was extraordinary work. It was the first and only real career in a corporation. It was an amazing confluence of ideals, thanks to Shu Knowles and colleagues that set the standard of the aesthetics. It was inspiring colleagues at all levels. No one was there for the money. It was the culture that drove us and continues to this day. And the fact that people didn't work just for the money meant that you got terrific people from all walks of life that simply wanted to serve the canons of design that Schunel had set down. The work spirit exuded confidence, and we succeeded against many odds. We were a very small company. At that time, we were 25 million. Now it's like a billion. But the positive camaraderie, I must say, it inspired our clients, and the clients were desiring to use our products. So it all worked out.
And for you personally, you said you started managing their graphics and showrooms.
Yeah.
And that was right around 1976, if I can place this in time. You were there for almost 30 years. So can you talk about your
years.
Yeah, can you talk about your personal evolution within the company?
Sure. I was asked to design and manage showrooms. Okay, I figured out that that was not terribly difficult. It was a lot of fun. It was a ton of work, but that could be done. And I started commissioning people to design the showroom when we could afford it, designers like Chinu Buhari. But with no management experience or real graphic education, I was still put to be responsible for graphic design, which was under the creative forces of Massimo and Leila Vignelli. Mm. And thanks to them, I was exposed to the most rigorous thinking in graphics, which really guides me today. I mean, when I take the subway here in New York, I'm constantly reminded that the whole subway map, which was, I think, done 30, 40 years ago, is still near perfect. There's sort of nothing you can do to make it better just because of their critical thinking. They were wonderful. I learned so much. Painfully, I learned to think in that manner.
You say painfully. Is that because it was just so much growth, like the learning curve was steep?
I needed to listen very, very carefully to understand what they wanted to get done and how to get it done and how things worked in a corporation. So it was very grateful for that opportunity. But then they asked me to move to Europe to head up product design.
This is an exciting leap.
Well, it was wonderful. Basically, it was Marshall Kogan, the co-owner of the company at that time. He wanted decisions rather quickly. I think he gave me like an hour to think about it or something like that. And I found that if you do say yes, and even if you don't quite know where you're going, you're going to learn a lot along the way. So I just said yes. And so he said, fine. He says, you're going to Paris and work out of the showroom and factory there until we get all the products streamlined and new products into the hopper. I said, yeah, fine, good. And then with that on the way, they asked me to move to London, where we were opening up a new, in a sense, a new company, and design the showroom that was on Savile Row for many years. Mm. I mean, very much, of course, enjoyed living in London. It was extraordinary.
And is that when you started your tie collection?
Yeah, it was the wide tie collection, which I'm now slicing and selling off as two thin ones. Then the company decided to buy a bunch of small firms in northern Italy, basically in Milan. So they asked me to move down there. So we did. You know, we got in the old car and drove it down. Worked with a variety, that's when I actually started getting a sense of what is Italian design. Mm-hmm. Working with extraordinary people like Gaio Lente and Richard Sapper, who is actually German but was working there. That was such a phenomenal time. And of course, that's also where I met my wife, architect Emanuela Frattini. It was a very joyous time. it really got me further into the processes, the manufacturing, respect of how development happens. Many people think that the designer just designs it and then, okay, so we're ready to put that into production. Not at all. Mm-hmm. It is even the best designers, you need a product development staff that often consists of engineers and people that know how to transpose the idea into manufacturing to the point where it is efficiently made, will last 20 years, inexpensive, available in any number of finishes, fabrics, etc., and make a profit for the company and pay for the tooling, etc. I mean, these are the things that really designers don't spend a lot of time thinking about, but those are the factors that indeed make a product successful and has a mark on society.
I mean, maybe I'm a little bit nerdy this way, but I think that's the exciting stage for me, because conceptually, designs can be anything, right? But when you start transposing them into manufacturability, that's when they become rooted in reality, and that's when you get to fine-tune them and refine them to make them actually work with real people and real circumstances. And then, as you well know, the ones that do that really, really well, they last a long time and they become icons. And that forging in the fire is the real alchemy of design, I think.
Very well put. I sometimes think of the analogy of the kitchen, where the kitchen is, you know, this in a restaurant, in this explosive area of things flying all over the place, some things working out, etc. And then finally, it's brought out on a very clean plate, presented by a waiter that's very smartly dressed, and it's presented before you. And all you need to do is add the right wine choice. But it's in the kitchen that is so much fun.
You're right.
You know, because that's where things go wrong and right, et cetera. And I think you're right. The development aspect of it is very much the unsung hero aspect of design.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, having worked in designing for various companies, the quality of the product development people is sometimes the make or break of it. I was then asked to come back to New York. This was probably 15 years into it all, or maybe more, to head up design worldwide out of New York. Not that any design happens in New York, it happens elsewhere. But nevertheless, the chair, the president wanted everybody close in his own zip code. So that brought me back to there. But it also brought me very interesting opportunities to commission people like Ross Lovegrove, who's fantastic, continues to be fantastically talented, and work with masters like Frank Gehry. Andrew Kogan, now CEO, was the one that actually first tapped Frank and worked with him on the Bentwood series. And then I acted as, I think, a surrogate designer to help produce some of the other models that came out. In all of these cases, especially if it's it's a great architect that's not used to designing furniture, such as Richard Meyer, you really need to work with the product developers and the craftspersons to make sure that the product comes out as it should. Mm-hmm. And it all worked well.
You were the guy that was facilitating all of this, right? You were spotting talent, bringing them in and helping them, guiding them through the product development process with that team and making sure that the output was Knoll ready.
Right. That was a responsibility. And of course, many people helping out. One of the persons that worked very closely with me was architect Albert Pfeiffer. we felt that Knoll had such a rich heritage. We've got to create the Knoll Design Museum. We had so many pieces in our history that I thought it was appropriate that we do a museum just for our own products. It became also a mine for reintroducing excellent designs. We also, aside from the normal duties of product development, created the Knoll Design Symposium at the Cranbrook Academy of Arts, where Shu Knoll was brought up with the Saarinen family. It came actually very quickly. We invited about 80 customers a year and about 15 speakers over a period of 8 years. I just said, talk about anything that you're passionate about. Do not present your portfolio. Do not talk about Knoll. Just talk about whatever you're passionate about for exactly 45 minutes. And that made it a lot easier, and it really was a lot of fun. Then, of course, the recession came, and we decided just drop everything when it came to the symposium.
I'd love for you to connect the dots between making the decision to leave Knoll and then founding your studio, CGM Design.
I decided, you know, maybe I should just try to figure out if I could do something else, perhaps sort of rediscover what my talents might bring. And so I decided to start on my own. What I discovered is actually I didn't do anything new. I just continued to do what I had been doing. I had an idea. I was driving, I think it was actually in Sweden, and I noticed these big aluminum trusses over the highways. I mean, the span is amazing. It's like 100 feet. And I wondered, why hasn't that been applied to furniture? It simply hadn't been thought of. So I ordered one of these trusses online and started to play with it and came up with the idea, maybe this could be a terrific benching system because you would then have up to 20 feet uninterrupted leg space and very fast assembly cost. Uh-huh. So I put together a prototype, showed it to Technion, and they said very quickly, we like it. That was product number one was on the way. And then I did 5 subsequent ones with them. At the same time, I was putting together this idea of an ambulance that would revolutionize high-density city problems. Out in the countryside, in the suburbs, etc., the normal ambulance is no problem. They're 10 feet wide, that's fine. But they're 10 feet wide for no particular reason, because inside the ambulance, there's not a lot you're allowed to do to the patient.
Okay.
And with sirens on, they creep through traffic at about double walking speed or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, when it comes to trauma, like automobile accidents or bicycle accidents, something like that, or heart attack, stroke, etc., you really need to get to the hospital fast. And 10 feet wide sirens don't do it. We've all heard them behind us, and we can't get our own car out of the way. And obviously, people are dying because we can't get out of the way. By redesigning the functions to about 4 feet wide, you could slip through traffic like nearly like motorcycles. You would separate the functions. I mean, you know, when a normal ambulance consists of an EMS sitting in the passenger seat and then a driver.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so you have two people. In this case, you reconsider all the functions and you have one person driving the tractor and the other person in the trailer with the patient. And then the trailer can actually be airlifted. It would have hooks that you could drop helicopter cables down and simply take it to the heliport at the closest hospital. My view is that you need to apply design to altruism.
I want to talk to you about your definition of design, because it's well-formed and well-documented, but I think it would be very powerful for our listeners to hear it directly from your mouth straight into their brains. So if you would share with us your design is definition, I'm not going to say it. I want you to say it.
Thank you very much. We've all been brought up to say, when you asked about design, you say, oh, form follows function. Well, when you think about it, it's just a circular argument, and it really doesn't help the designer-client relationship, because the client is embarrassed because they can't figure out quite what is that, and the designer gets embarrassed if they're asked to explain it, because it's. I thought about it quite a long time, and my definition of design is function with cultural content. The function is the objective aspect or left brain, which responds to logic, such as engineering and cost parameters. The cultural content is the subjective area, which includes human interaction, haptic qualities, history, aesthetics, and perceived value.
Mm.
By separating the two, you can discuss it with your client or customer or fellow workers, etc., to identify which part of design are you referring to so that we can improve it or change it or whatever. And then it's the designer's job to synthesize the two into needed and desirable products, which serve society when new, are repairable in use, if possible, and when obsolete can be repurposed and then finally recycled.
Yes. Hallelujah. Praise Carl Magnuson.
It's new. It's just what I have grown to believe and has been really practiced by many wonderful designers, you know, such as Niels Diffrient and others. Yeah.
Wow. That's a great philosophy. So with 50 years of professional experience, I'm sure you've seen lots of things evolve and change. You have a longer lens than most people through which to view the field and practice of design. So what patterns have emerged to you, and are there consistencies throughout the ages, or do you see problems that keep coming up throughout different generations? We just want to learn a little bit about your insights.
I mean, the way I learn or hopefully grow in design is observing what goes on outside of design. I visit trade shows that have nothing directly to do with design, such as transportation materials, sports, fabrics, gifts, aviation, agriculture. I mean, basically, you name it. You go to a show that you know nothing about, you will leave with some knowledge. The problem with you go to a wonderful design show is all it does is sort of tell you where you are with your product in the scheme of things. But I don't think you really learn something. I think that the best designers are the ones that go to the CES. That's one that I want to go back to, CES in Las Vegas, where you're finding out what's happening in the so-called computer and electronics show.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty amazing stuff. Or even if you go to lots of school shows, end of year graduate shows, they're terrific. You probably won't find out a lot about new materials, but you will find out what people, young designers, are thinking, mm-hmm. and how they're heading in their directions. Whether you agree with it or not, you do learn from it.
I'm curious. You seem like a person who's open to and hungry for information. You've had the extreme good fortune of having worked with some of the greats, and that's sort of, I'm sure some of it's luck, but a lot of it is, you know, you putting yourself there and being open to it. In your 50 years of professional experience, what personal quality would you attribute the majority of your success?
You know, the more I think about it, the more I'm grateful that I happen to be brought up on a farm, even though I never wanted to be a farmer, that's for sure. But the high work ethic and perseverance, that was the norm. And so that it was instilled without effort and has augured well, and quite frankly, I think brought me and our family happiness. My wife and kids feel the same way about high work ethic. The aesthetic sensibilities, I think, are thanks to my mother, because she arranged that we bring all our Scandinavian modern furniture. It wasn't Scandinavian modern. It was just furniture right. mm-hmm. in Scandinavia.
Right.
To Alberta in 1947. I mean, a rare sight indeed in a prairie farmhouse. Any interior I went to, you know, go over and visit a school mate at their home. And I always wondered, where did this stuff come from? Well, it all came from the Sears catalog.
Right.
But not a stick of modern furniture. So we were unconventional and an individual family, and we were always encouraged to be so. And I think that actually helped me when I got further on into design.
I have a question for you. It's just a theory that I'm forming after hearing you talk. But living and working on a farm, you got really aware of all the effort that and support that goes into planting seeds, nurturing crops, harvesting them. And some of that's up to, you know, the universe to rain and all of that. But Scandinavia seems like kind of farmland for design in that they plant the seeds and nurture and support design in a way that I think the U.S. could benefit from. Do you see similarities between farming and support in terms of design, economy, and culture?
You know, farmers, they never throw anything away. You will never see waste on a farm because they know how much effort went into creating a piece of food, for example. Scandinavian design has always been very much a question of less is more without necessarily bringing up Mises' slogans. Mm-hmm. There's a sparsity and there's a certain goodness out of making the minimum use, making the most use out of a minimum pieces of material.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is that. But I must say also that it took me a long time before I gave credit to my time on the farm because I didn't necessarily enjoy it. I mean, the amount of work was so high by everybody, and which all could disappear through bad weather
yeah.
or something like that. And so it's probably the reason why I never really went into that direction. But there's an awful lot to learn about just trying to be as close to nature as possible. You know, nature doesn't really throw anything away. It works as Spartan as it can for the survival of its own species. And I think that's an endless source of inspiration and guidance for us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wish I had studied history more and studied biology more so I could be more appreciative of those matters.
So what do you think about your future?
My own future is fine. I'm the real future, I believe, in a larger scale, the real future is as bright and as dim as our international cooperation in dealing with global climate change.
Hmm.
I just find it shocking and unconscionable how short-sighted politicians are concerning science and hence our children's Earth's future.
Mm-hmm.
We are in a real existential moment, and the people that can truly make a difference, I mean, it is politicians, because we as citizens, we want to take care of things for the future, but It's up to them to create cooperation so that we can continue with this earth.
Yes. Thank you for saying that, and thank you for saying it so forcefully.
So, since you're still designing, I'd love to know if you have some new products coming in the pipeline that you would like our listeners to know about.
Sure, I'd love to. I have quite a few new projects ranging from wristwatches to seating to tables. But as the convention is in our industry, I can't elaborate on it because of non-disclosure forms until it's released to the market.
Yes.
However, I continue to be called on writing short pieces for journals such as Metropolis, a chapter in a book on Craig Elwood's architecture, and a specialty Porsche collector magazine. I'm enjoying more and more the writing part of it, and it is the absolutely, I'm the least talented person to be called upon to string words together into sentence.
Well, I disagree, but I'm glad that you're enjoying it, and we would like to follow those writings and look for those articles and also your new projects when you can talk about them. So what's the best place to find you online?
The website, cgmagnuson.com.
Okay.
Or a YouTube called Thoughtful Design. And then on Instagram, hashtag CarlGusMag.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us. You have had a very storied life, and you've put a lot of good thinking and a lot of good products out into the world. So thank you for all your work.
Thanks for listening. To see images of Carl's work and read the show notes, click the link in the details of this episode on your podcast app, or go to cleverpodcast.com, where you can also sign up for our newsletter. Subscribe to Clever on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and we would love it if you would do us a favor and write a review or rate us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us a lot.
We also love hearing from you on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Tell us what you think of this episode and tell us who you want to hear from next. You can find us at Clever Podcast. Clever is created and hosted by us, Amy Devers and Jamie Derringer, also known as 2VDE Media, with editing by Rich Strappolino and music by L1011. Clever is proudly distributed by Design Milk.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. acast.com.